flying through. And so that's just the way every time a space shuttle used to dock, this is what they used to climb through to get it into the International Space Station, or before that, to Mir. They used to do the same thing at Mir. So, again, the docking vehicle successfully docked with the EIDR, the International Docking Adapter, and it had a soft dock, and then about a couple of minutes later, it pulled itself in to a hard dock and created its own seal and started eventually picking up power from the International Space Station. So it doesn't need to waste any of its battery power. It's now being charged by the space station. In the future, it will also be able to transfer fuel if they wanted to do that as well. For now, they spend quite a bit of time. Naturally, once this is developed, they'll open the doors and hatches very quickly. But this is the first time, and they were very careful. I got to see the door open early this morning, the hatch, and eventually the crew members went in. Two of them went in with gas masks on. They worry about fumes, and you know, you never know if there's any kind of a problem. So they go in with sniffers and testers, and then eventually they go back into the space station. And then they had a ceremony. You have three people on board the space station right now. In a couple of weeks, it'll go back up to six people. But for now, you have the three, and them on one. Right now, you have the American, a woman, Anne McLean, and then you have David St. Jacques. He's the astronaut from Canada, trained with NASA. And then you have the commander, Oleg Konienko, from Russia. And they show these three people floating around, preparing the Dragon crew vehicle for their little ceremony, which was nice. They all three stood in front of the main hatch inside the space station. Where it's attached to is the Harmony node. You have all these different modules, and this is the very front end of the space station, the Harmony node. You know, if you were to go to the port side, you'd be into the Japanese module. If you were to go right into the starboard side, you would be going into the Columbus European Space Agency module. All very large modules. But if you go directly forward, that is attached to this pressure mating adapter, and that was also relocated from another location a couple of years ago. And in the front of that, you have this other adapter, the International Docking Adapter. With that, they open up the door. The doors are now open after they set everything up, and they they set one in. And she, you know, because it's an American spacecraft, she went in, sat down in one of the seats, and saw the mannequin, sat next to the mannequin, and as well as the stuffed animal. And then she said, "Let me drop it." On behalf of Ripley, which is the mannequin, Little Earth, which was the stuffed animal, myself and our crew, welcome to the. Is talking to the audience and said, "Welcome to the crew, Dragon." She said, "Congratulations to all the teams who made yesterday's launch and today's docking a success. These amazing feats show us not how easy our mission is, but how capable we are at doing things. Welcome to the new era in spaceflight." So it's pretty cool. Next time this thing goes up, we'll be with a crew on board, two astronauts. They've been training for it for quite a few years. So this is going to stay docked at the space station until March 8th, 5 days or so. And then it's going to undock autonomously and then fly back to Earth. Usually when Dragon goes back, they send it to the Pacific Ocean. This time, it's going to the Atlantic Ocean. And they need to be able to do that comfortably because all the crew flights they plan on bringing back to the Atlantic Ocean. And this is going to probably land, you know, 400 miles or so out at sea. When the crew versions go, they'll probably go a little closer to the Florida. So there's a ship out there. It's called the Ghost Searcher, and it's by SpaceX. SpaceX has all their own recovery ships. It's a good-sized ship. It's got this capability of bringing the Dragon spacecraft back up onto the deck. It also has a helipad on the deck itself. It'll be equipped with a helicopter so that when the crews do come back, if there's any kind of health problems, there's going to be a medical team on board this ship, and if they need for any reason to fly them immediately back to land, they'll put them on a helicopter, take off from the helipad, and off they go. So, you know, they have quite a bit of infrastructure built in. SpaceX is doing all of this. They're very innovative and terrific. Spacecraft's going to come back with a heat shield. Hyper heat shield, again, developed by SpaceX. And going to have four parachutes. Usually, Dragon has just three parachutes when it's a cargo vehicle. This one's a little heavier. The whole spacecraft is much heavier than probably about, I think the cargo vehicles, I think around 18,000 pounds. 28,000, something like that. So roughly 10,000 pounds more in it. So therefore, it has another parachute, four big parachutes, and it will land in the ocean. So we'll see how it does on the 8th of this month. And if all goes well, like I said, they'll do the same thing all over again, probably in earliest July. But in between that, they do have one other mission that they're going to have to do, before they send the crew up, and it will be an abort test. So what they need to do is they need to take off with the Falcon 9 rocket from Launch Complex 39A, as if they have a mission, and they're going to fly this out over the ocean. And when they get up to maximum Q, that's the point in a flight where the atmosphere and the speed of the vehicle put most of the strain on the vehicle. They're going to duplicate an in-flight abort, and they're going to have the Super Draco engines. There's eight engines inside this vehicle, so not only have a crew, but you have eight engines, and they're going to ignite, and each engine pushes 16,000 pounds per square inch, so that's a total of 128,000 pounds of force. And, to give you an idea, it's over twice the amount of force that the original Redstone rocket had for Alan Shepard. Alan Shepard made it to, not orbit, but he made it to a suborbital flight with his 60,000 pounds, and this part of the vehicle, top part of the vehicle, part of the spacecraft is going to have 128,000 pounds of force to pull it away from the booster. Now, the booster that they're using, SpaceX reuses all their boosters. This one booster that just flew a week or so ago that launched an Indonesia satellite to geosynchronous orbit, and also launched the first spacecraft built by a company in Israel, SpaceL, to the moon. So that thing's on the way to the moon. Should get there April 11th. This booster that they used for that flight, that was the third flight for this booster. They call them Block 5 boosters. This is the final version of the Falcon 9. The earlier versions, they got two flights out of it. that was it. This thing gets, it got up to 10 flights, and then they'll rework it and do it again and again. They're taking maybe 100 flights. Well, this was flight number 3 on that last Indonesian flight. And they're going to use it one more time, and they're going to use it for the abort test. That should be coming up probably within a month or two. I don't have the date on that yet. But that will take off from Launch Complex 39A on this booster that's flown 3 times. It'll be the 4th flight. They don't plan on recovering this booster. Once those Draco engines light, it'll probably do some damage to the booster. And there's no plan on really recovering it. It will just go into the Atlantic Ocean. But the crew vehicle will come down miles away, and the recovery ship will be out there, and it'll come down with its 4 parachutes, and if there was crew on board, they would theoretically be saved. Once NASA sees that, it'll be 100% certified. They've done other abort tests back in 2015. They did one from the launch pad itself. As the booster was blowing up on the launch pad, and they had the crew version take off and go out into the ocean a couple of miles out, that was successful. So that's all they need to do. And after the next crew mission, one after that will be, maybe even 3 people going up next time, and eventually 4. They have 4 seats. The idea is once they get into regular rotation, you'll be able to bring 4 people up at a time. You team that up with the people from Russia, there's always 3 on board. Instead of having a regular contingency of 6 people on the International Space Station, you'll have 7 on a regular basis. That's the ultimate goal. So that's the story on that. Is there any questions on Dragon? Let me drop it before I even think about moving on. This is WS2N for the TechNet SpaceNet report. Okay, now within, about another, I think April or May, Boeing is supposed to do the same type of thing that I just described. Boeing's going to send up a Starliner. That should be an interesting flight. Boeing and Lockheed combined are called ULA, United Launch Alliance. And they've been launching Atlas V rockets like forever. I think there's almost 80 of them that they've launched. They launch from California, and they also launch from Florida. They use Launch Complex 41. If you were to go to Florida and look at Launch Complex 41 now and look up in the air, you would see another one of these crew access arms, similar but not the same as SpaceX, near the top of the launch tower. So they're getting ready to do the same thing. They plan on taking Starliner, which is, again, will be able to hold 4 people. Actually, both vehicles theoretically could hold 7, but right now there's no plans of doing that. But this one would have, again, 4 seats going to attach to the top of the Atlas V rocket, which has never taken a person up into space. They've had earlier versions of Atlases back in the John Glenn day that have done that, but these are completely different Atlases, of course, nowadays. Now, United Launch Alliance with the Atlas V has had a 100% success rate. Falcon 9, when it was being developed, not the Block 5, not the final version, but the Block 4, they had 2 explosions, one on a launch pad and another one in space. But Atlas V, 100% on all their launches. So Boeing is building the spacecraft to be put on top of this. They're going to launch with 2 solid rockets attached to the Atlas V. what's new with the, they could go up to five solid booster rockets on the Atlas. They've done that before. But this one's going to have two, and the difference is the second stage. The second stage, they're going to have two Centaur rockets. Usually they have one Centaur rocket with all their flights. They send rockets up to geosynchronous orbit all the time and all kinds of, you know, missions for NASA. And they always have one Centaur rocket. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen rocket. And this is going to be the first time that they have two on the second stage. So that's pretty interesting. And they want it for not only more power, but for redundancy. You're going to have a crew on board. They want to make sure they're going to get to orbit. So they'll do the same thing. They'll go up to space station, come in forward, and eventually dock with the International Docking Adapter, the ITER. So that should be pretty good. And they'll do the exact same thing, stay up there for 3-4 days. There is talk of once they get approved and they send a crew up, they're going to send a crew of three up instead of two, and maybe even on the first mission stay for many, many months. Apparently they feel like they're very confident with their Starliner vehicle. So hopefully within maybe months, definitely within this year, if there's no problems with these vehicles with that I'm talking about, you could have two vehicles being launched from American soil with people on it, American astronauts going up to the International Space Station, which will be a first since 2011 when STS-135, the last Atlantis, it was the Atlantis space shuttle left the space station. That was, 2011 in July. So here we are all these years later, finally getting to the point where we could get away from paying $80 million now per seat to go on the Russian Soyuz vehicle. That's how we get up there now. There's a launch coming up in a couple of weeks that will also be from Russia. It will now have a crew of six on board the station once that goes up in the middle of March. So that's it for now. Any questions or comments? There's always more stories, but to me this is the main story. We're getting ready finally to send people up into space. There's other things going on with NASA, with the Space Launch System and Orion, that's going to eventually be manned, but this one is like imminent. Space Launch System is probably a year or two away from actually having people on board. Any questions or comments? This is WS2N. Okay, and there are a couple of spacecraft that will be going up to orbit. You'll have the Orion spacecraft, and eventually you'll have the New Glenn spacecraft by Blue Origin. And really my question is, knowing what you know, which rocket would you want to ride on? Would it be this one that's up there now, by SpaceX on a Falcon 9, or would you want to fly on the Atlas V, on what Boeing and Lockheed put together, that has had 100% success rate with, although it never launched anybody yet at all, none of these have. Or would you want to go up on, wait a couple of years and go up on the Space Launch System, most powerful rocket ever devised that NASA is still putting together on the Orion vehicle? Or would you want to wait until Jeff Bezos from Blue Origin builds the New Glenn rocket, and that will launch out of Launch Complex 30, 36 out of Florida, and that's a very large rocket, maybe almost the size of the Saturn V. That will be liquid methane, liquid oxygen. So out of those four choices, you know, what one would you rather take, you know? And if you go up on the Orion, of course, that's not going to go to the space station. I have the capability to do that if they had to, but you'll be going to the moon. Any answers for that? This is WS2N. Okay, no comments. I thought I'd make that as a quiz, like what Roy does, but my guess is that if you're like me, I would go up on the Atlas V with that 100% success rate. That sounds good to me. I'm sure SpaceX is good, but I don't know. You take the experience of United Launch Alliance. They've been around, both of them, Lockheed and Boeing, for forever. I think that might be the safest way. Probably the most fun one would be to wait a couple of years and go up on the Orion on the Space Launch System that NASA is actually still building. Any questions or comments? Okay. I'll give you a couple of updates on what's going on. Curiosity, the rover that's riding around on Mars, is shut down for about 5-6 days now. They're trying to figure out what happened. The computer shut down and rebooted itself. Everything seems to be working, but they're going to stop the science for a while until they figure out exactly what's going on. They don't want to do something wrong and kill the Curiosity rover. It's the last rover working up there right now. All the past rovers that worked on Mars, of course, back in 1996, you had the Sojourner rover, the small one as big as a microwave oven riding around. Of course, that's long gone, and now the two solar power vehicles, Spirit and Opportunity, are now extinct. Spirit, we lost after 6 years of landing. It landed in 2004. That one got stuck, and this one lasted, Opportunity lasted about 15 years. And eventually, what killed that was the batteries went so dead from being in a global sandstorm, knocked all the light out for a couple of months, and apparently that killed Opportunity. So now we have a nuclear-powered one riding around called Curiosity. But that has some problems. They think they know what it is, and I'm sure, my guess, it will be back into operation very quick. Another interesting thing I came across was this company in Japan. They're building, it's called the iSpace, I-S-P-A-C-E. iSpace. It's a company that's going to be sending a vehicle to the moon in a couple of years, and they're going to launch with a private company. I'm not sure which one yet, but they want to send it with this new type of batteries. They're called solid-state batteries, which I read very little bit about, but the advantage of it is you can send it to an environment like the moon, and you don't have to worry about them freezing, not working properly because it's too cold. So solid-state batteries, apparently they've been under development like for 100 years, but nobody's had much luck with it. Apparently this company is a spark plug company, NGK, and I'm buying this spark plugs for cars, has now invested in iSpace and plan on developing these solid-state batteries. Apparently they don't have a liquid or gel-like electrolyte. It's all solid. So I'm going to be curious to see how Hakuka, H-A-K-U-T-O, it's a lander and a rover, are going to fare using solid-state batteries. This company, iSpace, was like this last one that went up by Israel. They were competing for the Google Prize and just kept on going, even so the Google Prize said that was it. That was it if you couldn't launch by 2017. You were out, but they continued on, and they plan on launching in 2020 and landing in 2021. This is solid state batteries. Never heard of them, but tried to read up a little bit about it. Apparently, it's some kind of glass or ceramic type of electrolyte that's involved. So we'll see. Has anybody ever heard of solid state batteries?
Yeah, that's a new one on me. Paul, did they say the maximum temperature and the minimum temperature it can tolerate? And did they also mention how many charge-discharge cycles it can go through before it wears out, so to speak? Oh, you, Paul, K2LAW.
Yeah, they're not worried about the temperature. It could go as cold as you like or as high as you like. They don't care. It's different than lithium-ion batteries. They don't need to be kept, above a freezing temperature. Where the lithium-ion ones that they send up, they always send like little nuclear pellets up to keep them warm. This, they say, you won't need to do it. They say it could be. The downside is, if you bang them around too much, they might crack. It's like a ceramic electrolyte rather than a liquid electrolyte. So I'll have to look more into it. That's pretty much all I got on it, Dick. But, I read the history of it. Apparently, they've been trying to do this for years. And in 2017, in Japan, this NGK Sparkplug company apparently made a breakthrough. And, extremely high amp hour batteries that they can get out of these things.
KP2GS? Roy recognized that was going to be my next question. How are they in energy density? Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, they've been knocking around since Michael Faraday's time. The guy in 2017 that presented a version is also the co-inventor of the lithium-ion battery, so that's a good thing. And he describes it as using a glass electrolyte and alkali metal anode, something either lithium, sodium, or potassium. It apparently has a very high energy density, very good with recycling times, ridiculously expensive, and not quite ready for prime time, generally. But very safe, because it tends to not explode, because solid solid cathodes and such are less likely to than the paste that they use for the other types of batteries.
What's your guess, Roy, as to what was the breakthrough? What allowed them to make a solid-state battery for the first time when apparently they've wanted to do this for a long time?
Going back again, they've had solid-state batteries to one degree or another since Faraday's time. They used silver sulfides and lead fluorides to do it. But the problem is getting the price down, so maybe he's discovered some manufacturing technique that makes it the price reasonable for a change.
Price-wise, they said like 10 years ago, for a 20-amp solid-state battery, they were talking about $100,000, but apparently they made a breakthrough with it. That's no longer true.
Probably only $10,000.
Well, that's good. that would be a big difference. And then they keep going. And knows? I mean, they are gonna put them on this spacecraft. So that would be the first time that they ever launched into space. And as you know, anything that goes up into space usually is at the premium price.
They put it in pacemakers, by the way, in the past. I think exactly.
You flipped out. Did you say pacemakers? They have them in pacemakers now.
I'm saying that they at one point or another, they actually tried them in pacemakers. I think it was just an experiment because they made the pacemakers ridiculously expensive. But they have been used in the past, as well as RFIDs and other things. But purely experimental because of the ridiculous cost.
Is the battery expensive because it's got expensive materials, or is it an expensive manufacturing process? What do you think, Paul?
Yeah, I would say manufacturing. I mean, it's basically glass for electrolyte, you know. I would say getting these substances together, you know, and then I guess they have to be compressed to a certain degree to be functional. And also to make it where it doesn't shatter. The article I read, it has a shattering problem. You don't want to bang it around. So I guess when they have a soft landing on the moon, they're probably going to tell them, make sure it's a real soft landing.
Or you have to put the battery in a pole. As we get near the end, I'm going to be asking you guys, how much snow do you have at your house? Back to you, Paul.
I don't even want to look out the window. I'll have to check later. The hybrid motors you asked about last week, I looked a little bit about the hybrid motors. On Virgin Galactic, that's the one that's going to be sending up 8 people at a time on suborbital flights, and they have this HTPV fuel. And you asked about the oxidizer. Well, they have the oxidizer within this fuel mixture, but they subsidize the oxygen with nitric oxide, you know, laughing gas. They have a tank, and the tank, it's being forced, pressurized by helium, and it's pushing this nitric oxide into the solid, somewhat solid rocket chamber, and that's how they could adjust the amount of thrust. Usually, with a solid booster rocket, you know whatever comes out. You can't really adjust the thrust. This you can with the amount of oxygen that you supply to it. So that's why they're using it there. That was HTTV. I wrote it down somewhere. What the heck this was. But apparently they're happy with it. They didn't like the first version of it. They were having problems after like 20 seconds. It would cut out on them. And, then reignite. Problems like that. Where this, they don't have that problem. It's hydroxyl terminated, here we go, polyuridine, that's what it is. There's your answer, Dick. That's the best I could find. But that's what these people are going to be risking their lives on Virgin Galactic, going up on Spaceship 2 equals it.
So there is a separate tank with the oxidizer, and the rate at which you put in the oxidizer controls the thrust?
Yes, and it's being pressurized with another helium tank, so that's how they're forcing the liquid oxygen or nitric trioxide, laughing gas, into the chamber. Apparently it's a methane tank. I haven't figured that out.
Maybe as you put in different amounts of the oxygen compound, you put in different amounts of methane to keep the oxygen to fuel ratio the same during the high and low thrust uses. That's a guess.
Yes, that sounds like a good guess. That would fit the bill. But I know you asked about that last week, so that was the information I had on that. That's okay. I think that's about it for now. I think I don't have any other comments or topics to go by. I'll turn it back to you or anybody else with any questions. K2RIWWS2X.
Anybody with any further questions for Paul?
the B-2 be up cell here. Wondering what's happening with the Chinese space probes, moon probes. I understand one or more of them actually has an HF receiver on it. Go ahead.
The ones that went to the moon, is that BXO. I forgot the name. Sorry. Back to you.
Yes, I was asking about the Chinese moon probes. If I remember correctly, one or more of them, either the orbiter or the lander on the so-called dark side of the moon, actually have an HF receiver on them. Not sure to listen so much for natural phenomena or ETs or both. Seems like a great location to listen for ETs from, since there's no solar, a noise in the dark, and no HF noise from Earth. My name is Frank, by the way. I apologize. I should have given you that. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks, Frank. And they had a couple of experiments. They wanted to actually do radio astronomy on that side of the moon. They did have an HF receiver for that purpose. Naturally, you're going to black out everything from the Earth. So, like you said, that was the perfect location. I haven't heard if they haven't released any information on that yet. I know they have it. I'm not even sure if they've turned it on. It's been up there for a month or so now. And they've survived a couple of night times. So we'll look forward to that. And they're supposed to have seeds on board with some kind of liquid water that's going to try to germinate seeds. They have it looks like a glass. They really expect to grow something. I heard something started to grow. So that was one of their experiments. And to get their information back, they have a repeater in the sky in a halo orbit. So it's sitting, as far as the dark side of the moon is concerned, it's looking at that dark side of the moon all the time. Not really orbiting the moon. So they're transmitting up from, the rover. They have a little rover, and the rover transmits back to the lander. And last I heard, the rover was about 400 meters away. Let me drop it. And then from the lander, they're transmitting up to the repeater. That's supposed to be all on UHF, and then transmitting back. They said on, I thought they said S-band, which was weird. You know, everything we do is pretty much X-band on our long transmissions. But I think they said S-band. I think it has to do with their receiver capabilities on Earth. We're not letting them the deep space network, so they're on their own there. We don't have agreements with China. That's why they're not on the International Space Station with us. They're not one of the 20 countries that are involved. So if for some reason they're coming back on S-band, I'll have to look to see the reason for that. And that's the story. That's all I know on that, Frank. Back to you.
Yeah, okay. It's kind of fascinating. It just seems like a fantastic idea, and kind of obvious idea to put an HF receiver on the backside of the moon, shielded from all the Earth noise, and see what you hear. And I think it'll be really interesting if they release what they hear. Yeah, as I understand it, though, we're not letting them use our networks or onto the space station because of their attitude toward our intellectual property, something that hopefully will be resolved in the near future, because it seems kind of ridiculous. Though people who care about the intellectual property are probably very concerned about it. One other question, if we have time. I wonder what's happening with exoplanet research. I watched a video today. It's about 6 years old, from the University of Arizona, where Chris Impey, the astronomer, says that we're pretty close to being able to detect Earth-sized planets using various methods. And and perhaps to, and have done proof of, at that time had done proof of concept for looking for biomarkers. I was wondering if you've followed anything more recent. Go ahead.
Well, Kepler has stopped working, but now to pick up the slack, we have TESS that's, you know, sending terrific information back, scanning the whole sky, essentially, you know, on a 28-day basis. So it's going out to the lunar distance, coming back to Earth on a highly elliptical orbit when it comes near Earth, when not near, you know, 60,000 miles away. It transmits all the information that it got back. So that's looking for more planets, but you're looking for methane and all. We're going to have to wait for two telescopes really to help with that, and that's going to be the James Webb Space Telescope in a couple of years. That's way behind schedule, and that should have the capability of doing that. And another one that they're developing now, and that's probably have to wait maybe 3 or 4 years, and that's, they call that WFIRST. WFIRST is going to be in orbit around Earth, but it's going to be able to be sensitive enough to do what you're saying, maybe even look for you know, methane or oxygen or something, you know, some atoms out in the with these planets that they find. It's also going to be able to find more Earth-like planets further from the star, you know, from the star system. They'll be able to, instead of looking, you know, say 100 million miles, you know, or less, it'll go even further out. Right now we have a tough time doing that. It's been done, but this thing might do it on a regular basis. They call it WFIRST. They do have the funding for it. They were having trouble getting funding for it. But apparently they do have it now. And what WFIRST is really like a leftover Hubble Space Telescope. They got it from the NRO, National Reconnaissance Orbiter. Instead of taking a Hubble Space Telescope and looking out to the sky, they took a similar type of deal, and they looking down and using them as spy satellites. And they had two extra that they didn't use, so NASA took over one, and they're going to develop it with all this high-tech stuff to, you know, spectrometers and everything. So hopefully WFIRST might be able to do something with what you're saying, Frank. Back to you, WS-20.
Paul, is WFIRST going to be in a similar orbit to Hubble, higher or lower, with repair missions? What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's definitely going to be an Earth orbit. At one time, they were thinking about a Lagrange point for it, but now I heard the latest, last year or two, they said it's going to be Earth orbit, and yet I would be, you would be able to get up to it. We don't have a vehicle, of course, now that could do it, but in the future, they're thinking, you know, downrange, you're going to have Dream Chaser, and Dream Chaser might be able to do that. It's a very small shuttle. Might be able to do it. You know, we have nothing as big as the shuttle anymore. You know, to give you an idea, the three vehicles that will be able to go into space with people are going to be the Soyuz rocket, I mean, the Soyuz spacecraft, the Dragon crew vehicle that's up there now, and Boeing. If you take all three and put them one behind another, they all fit inside the cargo bay of the space shuttle. Interesting fact. Back to you, Dick.
I'm going to guess that WFIRST has a mirror a little bit smaller than Hubble. I think that was offered way back in the days when Hubble was being constructed, and they wanted to build a larger mirror. So I think it might be a little smaller. And you don't have the shuttle to launch it, so it can be launched with some of the current boosters. Back to you, Paul.
Oh, yes. SpaceX could do it, and even if it was heavier, they could do it with their Falcon Heavy that they built. Yeah, no problem. And I heard the same. It's the same size as same diameter as Hubble. They had two left over, and they have them in storage. So they told NASA, "Here, take this one."
What's your guess as to how much snow you got? I think I've got about 2 inches here. Roy, Do you see how much snow you've got to your house?
Yeah, it looks like about 2 inches, give or take.
Okay. This is the end. It's midnight, 73 you all. Back to you for any final words on addresses you usually give out, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW.
Okay, thank you very much, Dick. And to put the cherry on the top of the cake, I looked up the neutrino image. It was taken over 500 days of recording, and they couldn't do it, you know, 24 hours a day, because it had to be in the right location for the sensor. So it's 500 days worth of scanning for those few pixels. So go figure. It's a beautiful, ugly picture. Anyway, anytime anyone has any topics or questions or subjects or reputations, feel free. The email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And the links are all available on my webpage, roy.ac2gs.com. And Bill WB2QGZ emailed me that he wasn't able to transmit, but he heard our little discussion on time standards, so that's a good thing. Anyway, thanks to everyone who participated, thanks to everyone who listened, and thanks, of course, to Dick and Paul. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week with hopefully more puzzles. I can't wait to figure out what they might be. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and I'll be clear.
Thank you, Roy. Bye-bye for now, and see you guys later. K2RIW clear, but listening.
WB2GXM.
Yes, Rich, who you want to talk to?
Ring of Error, KE2EJ is still around. I hope he's feeling better, that's all.
The time is 12.04 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.
Visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
830 W2VL repeater system. Time is 5 a.m. Net tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL amateur radio repeater system.
Thank you.
tonight at 8:30. This is the W2VL Amateur Radio Repeater System.
KD2KNH Mobile.
KD2KNH, here is KD2YHY. Good morning, my name is Steve.
Dave, Charlie here, Patchogue, westbound.
Good morning, Charlie. Southern State Parkway in Belmore, and I'm going east. Both sides look to be about the speed limit.
Roads out here are great. No snow, no ice. Everything's being salted. A Sunrise Highway, so I can't complain.
Well, very good. The roads here, well, at least the highway, is just wet. I think tonight, when it goes below freezing, it's going to be fun, but right now, it's just wet.
Unless we get an accumulation of some rain, you know, the salt should stay, and I really haven't checked the weather reports.
The melt.
I think it might get a little melt today, but before I left the house, it said starting tonight, tomorrow, and Wednesday, it's going to be pretty cold. So, we'll see what happens.
Yeah, I had heard it's going to be cold all week, but, spring's approaching. Almost over.
Seasons have shifted. Kilo Delta 2, Golf Alpha Go.
I didn't catch what shifted. Try it again.
Kilo Delta 2, Golf Alpha Golf. The seasons have shifted.
Ah. Okay. Yeah. Well, News 12 said Sunday it might hit 50.
Heard that as well. The other station, pick it up.
Not sure if you noticed in the last 10 years, but everything's kind of shifted. Now we have, like, snowstorms till the end of March. So, I think it just does that, you know? I mean, I remember back when I was a kid, we had, you know, 4 feet of snow, or close to it, you know? And then a couple years ago, we had 33 inches. So, I mean, all in March and April. So, and that's never happened when we were children. I know that for a fact. I don't know about you guys. You seem pretty, you know, you seem like you're about the same age as me. I believe that everything is kind of moving over to the right a little bit.
Well, there's no doubt that there's not as much snow in November and December as I seem to remember. You know, you got to look at the printed records. Because, let's see, I would say, trying to think how long ago, just about 30 years ago, I did a trip up to New Hampshire the day before Thanksgiving, and it was a snowstorm on Long Island where we got, I think, a foot and a half, and it seemed like it followed me all the way up New England, and that was the day before Thanksgiving, but I don't recall much of that later on. Charlie?
Well, my recollection, which is as faulty as everybody else's, was that it seems like the weather patterns of the 60s are returning. We did have snows later and, colder winters. I mean, I had a lake in my backyard as a child, and we would skate for a month or two. The ice would freeze over, and, you just don't see that anymore. But I think it's returning.
Very interesting. That's cool. You had a lake? That's amazing. Oh, that must have been a blast. That's probably where you learned how to skate, and then you probably played ice hockey and stuff. That's great. Well, you know what? I don't know. I just noticed that everything is wacky. I mean, my birthday was yesterday. I turned 51, and I just remember it never.